Genesis chapter 6, and I'm going to be right up front with you, this is a horrendous piece of scripture. I never really enjoyed teaching it. I only enjoy reading it. I mean, after all, reading about the destruction of the world and everyone in it is not really a happy material to be meditating on. Also, it's a difficult portion to teach because it's not very linear. It's almost as if this destruction of the world is written in a way that's very disjointed and zigzaggy. And the narrative jumps one way, then it jumps another, and then jumps forward and jumps back. And it's like a feeling of chaos when you read this, when you really just come to it and read it. And if you read it, the more times you read it, the more you see this. It's not smooth and linear like most of the scripture is. So it's not an easy passage to teach. It's certainly not a fun passage to teach, but it's an important passage to teach. So we're just going to jump into it, and we'll see how far we get, and what we don't do this week, we'll pick up with next. So Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. And it came to pass, when man began to increase upon the ground, and daughters were born to them, the B'nai Elohim, some translations say the sons of God, or the sons of the rulers, we'll come back to it in a moment, the B'nai Elohim, saw that the daughters of man were good, and they took themselves wives from whomever they chose. And Adonai said, my spirit shall not, and yet this word's difficult because it's the only place it's found, the word danut, it has something to do with judging, contending, always trying to fix, trying to discipline, trying to move man. My spirit shall not contend or judge or wrestle evermore concerning man, since he is but flesh. His days shall be 120 years. Now notice who says that in verse 3. It doesn't say Elohim says it. It says Adonai says it. And remember, Adonai always represents God's attribute of mercy. So it's the God referring to himself by his attribute of mercy, says, my spirit shall not contend evermore concerning man, since he's but flesh. And what's he about to do? He's about to wipe him out. We must realize that this is an act of mercy. And we'll see why as we go through. Verse 4. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of the rulers, or the B'nai Elohim, would consort with the daughters of man, who would bear to them. They were the mighty ones of old, men of renown, men of name, men of reputation. Adonai saw that the wickedness of man was great upon the earth, and that every product of the thoughts of his heart was but evil always. And Adonai reconsidered having made man on earth. And he had heartfelt sadness. Heartfelt pain is really the word. And Adonai said, I will blot out man whom I created from the face of the ground. From man to animal to creeping things and to birds of the sky. For I have reconsidered my having made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of Adonai. All right, well, the first thing that kind of overshadows the whole passage is, who are these B'nai Elohim? Who are these sons of God? Didn't God just have one begotten son? Yes, he only had one begotten son. But we're called sons of God, children of God. And then you've got these apparently angelic creatures called B'nai Elohim. But there are three general opinions as to who these people are. One, I think, is the weakest opinion, is that the B'nai Elohim are referring to the children of Seth, and they intermarried with the daughters of Cain. You have these two lines, right? Cain is the cursed line, and Seth is the blessed line, and they intermingle. No, they probably did, and it probably wasn't real pleasing to God that they did. Opinion number two, a little stronger, is that the rulers, see, the word Elohim is a word that doesn't just mean God. There are a few passages in Scripture where Elohim means judges, men, human people, human judges. A few examples are in Exodus 22:8. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the Elohim to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. This is referring to judges. Shoftim is another word for judges, but sometimes they're called Elohim. In the same chapter, next verse, Exodus 22:9, for every breach of trust, whether it is for ox, for donkey, for sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before the Elohim. He whom the Elohim condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. So Elohim is applied to people, and there are other examples. There's a place in Psalms, have I not called you all Elohim? And that's translated, haven't I called you all gods? So the word Elohim is an odd word. It means powers. And of course, the one supreme Elohim is God himself. But he also invests in people on earth powers and authority. So we have to be very careful as we see the word. Predominantly, the word is referring to God, but not always. Okay, we must look at the context. But the strongest argument is that these B'nai Elohim are actually angelic creatures. The reason I say that is because B'nai Elohim is used four times in the Bible. Two times right here that we've already read, here in chapter 6. We saw both occurrences here in Genesis. The other two times are over in the book of Job. The first chapter of Job and the second chapter of Job. Here's the first occurrence in Job. Now there was a day when the B'nai Elohim came to present themselves before Adonai, and Satan also came among them. And you can read the account. And God is talking to these, well, he's talking to Satan, who is also an angel. And Satan says, let's have this little context with Job here. And then in the next chapter, Job 2, verse 1, the term B'nai Elohim is used a second time. Because they appeared before God a second time, and Satan's also among them. And he says, let's up the ante on this contest with Job. And obviously here, it's referring to angelic creatures and not to men. Now you may wonder, how is it that angelic beings, which are spiritual, can have a physical intercourse with human women who are physical? I don't know. I do know that creatures on the higher plane can easily drop to a lower plane. But creatures on the lower plane do not very easily move up to a higher. In fact, it's pretty much impossible. For example, you have a dog or a cat. You communicate with this cat. You play with the cat or the dog. You train the dog to do tricks. Cats don't do tricks, but you can train the dog to do tricks. And you have interactions. So you can understand how the dog thinks. That dog will never understand how you think. You can move down to its level. In fact, you could live like a dog. But the dog can never rise up to live like a human. It will still go out there and roll in things it shouldn't roll in and eat things that no animal should ever eat and do things in public that no one should ever do in public. It's a dog, all right? But humans can descend to that level, but a dog cannot ascend to the human level. So it's not difficult for an angelic being, and we see accounts of them in the scriptures and extra-biblical accounts of angels appearing and just appearing and acting like a human being. So somehow appearing in a physical form and taking on physical form is no big deal. They can do it. All right. Now, this interaction between these beings and these human women is something that Peter also refers to. So just lifting a chunk out of 2 Peter 2, we're looking at verses 4 and 5. It says, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartarus, and I'm not going to try to translate the word. Apparently, it's some kind of part of the underworld, the spiritual underworld, the realm of darkness, and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others, his wife, his three sons, and their wives, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. So Peter here is alluding to this episode that we're reading about. Now, this explains some things, too. It says these became men of renown. Anshei Shem is the word, is the phrase in Hebrew. Men of name, men of renown. And they were of a giant size. They were big and they were powerful and they had superpowers, I guess. And they're called the Nephilim. And what's interesting is that if you read in mythology, and I know many of you are up on this more than I am, you've done more study than I have, but you're going to find something interesting. If you look at the mythologies around the world, whether it's Greek or Roman or Egyptian or Japanese or Chinese or Nordic mythology, you find some common elements. You find a god, some kind of a godlike creature, a spiritual being, somehow having intercourse with a human female, and then you've got this god-human offspring as a result, who themselves are called gods. Here are some examples. The ancient Germans worshipped the virgin Hertha with a child in the arms of his mother. The Scandinavians called her Disa, pictured with her child. In Egypt, the mother and her child were worshipped as Isis and the infant Osiris. And Ra is the godlike father, Isis the human mother, and this Osiris is this god-human hybrid. And in India, the mother and the child were called Devakiland and Krishna, and Isi and Isawara. As they are worshipped to this day in Asia, they were known as Sibyl and Dioeus. In pagan Rome was Fortuna and Jupiter. In Greece is Ceres, the great mother with a baby at her breast, and the boy is Plutus. In Tibet, China, that goes on and on and on. They all have the same theme. This is what we think happened. In a few chapters, when the flood's over, we'll get to the story of the Tower of Babel. And it says that all the people were of one language. And at that time, there was a religious system, a false religious system, based, we think, upon this part in chapter 6, where these angelic creatures, spiritual beings, had offspring with human women. And these offspring became the gods of this Babylonian religion. And in Revelation, Babylon is called the mother of all false religions, the mother of abominations. All false religion traces its source back to Babel. But when God confused the languages and the people scattered around the world, they took their false religion with them. And that's why all the mythologies of the world have these common core beliefs. You get it? They just go by different names because the languages were changed. So you have the false religion of Babylon like a puddle, and God goes smack and it scatters and it goes everywhere. Now some of you think, well, wait a minute, that sounds a lot like God's spirit coming upon Mary and then Yeshua is born. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Here's the thing you have to understand. God does not imitate Satan. Satan imitates God. You know, some people look at the layout of Egyptian temples and pagan temples, and guess what? They have an outer court, a holy place, and a holy of holies. How did they get that idea? Well, Moses was told by God, I want you to make the tabernacle according to the pattern I showed you, the heavenly pattern I showed you on the mountain, right? Well, who else got to see that heavenly pattern? Who else is in the heavens and saw all of this? Satan was. So what does he do? He imitates it in all these other pagan religions. But even though Satan imitates and counterfeits the real, God does not change the real. Say, well, I just can't use that anymore. Satan stole that one from. He doesn't do that. Truth is truth is truth, whether the enemy imitates it or not. We don't put the truth aside because the enemy imitates it. It's like somebody counterfeiting $100 bills, so they say, well, we're just not going to make $100 bills anymore. We'll start making $200 bills. Okay, well, they're just going to counterfeit that. You don't change the genuine because it gets counterfeited. And God had this plan. He had promised Eve in the garden that she would have a seed that would crush the serpent's head. Right? Well, so then we thought, well, you know, I'm going to beat him to that one. I'm going to start having some seed here that will crush the children of Adam. You understand? Especially the descendants of Jacob. So don't be shocked by this, because you'll read how people say, well, the whole story of God and Mary and Yeshua, this is all just an imitation of the pagan cultures and myths. No, it's not. They are a copy and an imitation, a cheap counterfeit of the real. But there are other differences too. There are other differences. God and Mary did not have any kind of physical intercourse. God forbid. I even hate saying the words because of that image. And there's not this half-human, half-God hybrid. Yeshua is something entirely different. Entirely different. The part you could not see of Yeshua, the soul of Yeshua, it was the very neshama that God breathed into Adam's nostrils. Remember what Paul says, that he came, he arose a life-giving spirit, a neshama. He was God's very life. He was utterly divine. The physical part of him is completely and totally human, not half God. He was utterly human, completely, totally human. Right? It wasn't 50-50. It's something completely unique and different. So I don't like spending time on this because it's so distracting. And you know, when people who start reading this, they form clubs. Do you know that? They form clubs and societies. They get together on an annual basis and they talk about this stuff and do research. It's like, I don't have time for that. I'm going to know how this applies to me. I'm going to know how this is profitable for righteousness and for instruction and righteousness and my life. I'm not interested in these myths and these half-deities or whatever you want to call them. That bores me. But it's information we still need to know and then move on with it. So we're going to let Dan share something here and then we're going to move on. So let's get, oh yeah, microphones. We need a microphone up here for Dan, please. Other Dan.
I just got a question here.
Just hold it up close to your mouth. Okay, there you go.
I just don't know how to operate these things. In Mark here, Jesus answering about marriage and the resurrection, mm-hmm. I'm sure you're aware of this. Could you explain to me then where Jesus talks about in heaven,
neither you're like the angels and neither married nor given marriage. Yeah. That's in heaven. Okay. They had to come to earth to do this. Yeah.
Oh, so there's a, I still don't understand.
I don't either.
Right? Thanks.
I do know we talked about this in the Matthew study. So, but I wasn't listening at the time. You'll have to go back and hear what I said. But I was told it was good. So anyways, but no, that's a great question. I'm sure other people had the same thing. But yeah, I mean, we can go off to all kinds of things. There's all kinds of questions it brings up. But you know, there's something very personal here that we can apply from this story to ourselves. And that's what I wanted us to get to. What's the practical teaching for you and me? That we have to beware of angels descending into our bedrooms at night? No, no. But what you do see a principle here. Because the narrative will say something about what happened, and then it will give God's response. Then it will go back to what happened. Then it gives God's response, and it goes back to what happened, and it back God's response. Notice that back and forth through the narrative in these 9 or 10 verses that we've read. So here it says, first of all, the B'nai Elohim in verse 2 saw the daughters of man were good, and they took themselves wives for whomever they chose. They just took them. And apparently the women were happy to be taken. So what is God's response? Verse 3, my spirit shall not contend evermore concerning man, since he is but flesh. The two key words here are spirit and flesh. My spirit, God is spirit, my spirit shall not always contend with man, since he is flesh. And he limits his lifespan to a maximum of 120 years. The principle here is this. The division between the spiritual and the physical, if there's really one there at all, is very, very porous. Our five senses do not sense the spiritual realm. So we're tempted to think there isn't one. We see, we hear, we feel, we taste, we can smell things, but only physical things. And since our spiritual sensitivities are so undeveloped and so embryonic in ways, or numb, we tend to think there's not a spiritual realm. And people who become scientists just poo-poo the whole idea of the spiritual. But let me tell you something. The spiritual and the physical are very much intertwined. And whether you know it or not, or believe it or not, there are influences that come into your soul, which is a spiritual thing, that come from the spiritual realm. Truth comes from the spiritual realm, and deception comes from the spiritual realm. And as the rabbis say, the modern rabbis, I say the human soul, the human mind is like a radio. It gets only two stations. And you have to be careful to always tune it to the one and not the other. Because if you're not watching the dial and maintaining the tuning on that dial, it's not a digital radio, it's a dial, it'll just kind of go over to the dark side. And we are so easily deceived. Robin and I have had recent conversations. I don't think she'll mind if I share them, but and experiences we have. Because how many of you have ever felt, let's say, utterly hopeless? Utterly hopeless. And the reason you and your human thinking, you think, oh, I feel hopeless because this is negative, and that's a train wreck, and this is bad. There's no good outcome to this. And you look at evidence in your life, and some of the evidence tells you there's just no hope. What you don't fail to see is hopelessness itself is something that comes from the spiritual realm, and it comes like a blindfold over your face. And you're mad because the electrical company cut off your electricity. And people who do have light say, quit being hopeless. Take the blind. Listen, I have good reason to be hopeless. And they'll name all these things. But they don't realize hopelessness is this third thing. It's not part of them. And it's not part of reality either. It's a third thing that was put onto them without them realizing it. But they think hopelessness is truth, because they have all this evidence in their lives. But if they could just remove the blindfold, all of a sudden the evidence changes. Oh, now I see reality. And they're filled with hope. You understand? Fear is the same thing. People who have lots of fear, they can name all the things they're afraid of. They don't see that fear is a blindfold. It's a third thing. It's not part of them. It's not part of reality. It's this third thing that has invaded their lives and completely distorted their reactions to everything. Anger. Well, I have reason to be angry. They can name all the things that make them angry. But like the rabbis say, things don't make you angry. They just reveal the anger that's in you. The anger is the third entity. It's not part of you. It's not part of reality. It's this third thing that comes between you and reality that makes your mind not function the way it should. Those are the enemies. The fear itself, the hopelessness itself, the anger itself, and whatever else you want to put in there. Those things are the spiritual enemies. And this is why the battle is always in the mind and the thoughts that come in, thoughts of hopelessness, anger, and fear. You take them captive. You take them like in the movies and you duct tape them to a chair. You shine a bright light in their eyes. And you demand more than just their name and their serial number. What are you doing here? Where did you come from? What is your right to be here? And you do not let that thought take one more step into your experience and into your life until you find out its source. All I need to know is its source. And once I know its source, I know whether to embrace it or to reject it. But my thoughts aren't usually my thoughts. They're a radio signal that comes from the outside. Now, on the other hand, there's inspirations that come in. There are these jolts of light that just illuminate something in the Word or something in a relationship. Those also come from the spiritual, but they're coming from the light. But we need to wake up and realize there are spiritual invaders in our lives. And if we let our guard down, if we're not careful, they will attach themselves to us. They will reproduce in us giants. It's a giant. We can't kill it. Run away, you know. And but then when you realize, wait a minute, get this out of here. All of a sudden, the giants shrink down. You know what's so funny? When the spies went into the land, do you know, they were in the land for 40 days. They come back with a report. Oh, the Anakim. These are supposedly the descendants of Anak, who's one of the descendants of the Nephilim. I don't know. It's all confusing. There were like grasshoppers in their sight. But when they get over there, that just seems like there's no issue. Then they did find, was it two or three brothers? So I think it was three brothers, sons of Anakim, in one area of Hebron. This was given to Caleb. And Caleb's at least 60 years old, maybe closer to 80 years old. So here's Caleb, a man of God who sees things clearly. He doesn't have any blindfolds, any baggages in his life. And what does he do? This, let's say 80-year-old man goes there and just he kicks their butts. Off they're gone. They're no competition. Because he can see reality. He could see who God is. He could see who these guys were. They weren't giants to him. They were just like an infestation of cockroaches and bugs, and just get them out of here. They were nothing. They're gone. If we can see truth, if we can see reality, we are free people. This is why Messiah says to those who believed on him, if you continue in my word, then you'll know the truth. And the truth will make you free. Because if you continue my word, then you're my disciples indeed. And you will know the truth. And the truth will set you free. The way you get free of hopelessness, realize you're not seeing things truly as they are. So you need a dose of truth. Truth is light. Are you angry? Then find the truth. Truth is light. And the anger goes away. Are you afraid? You just don't have enough truth. Get the truth. When you read the truth, there's nothing to fear. You follow? So this is a very practical lesson for us. And if we don't deal with these things, they will deal with us. And they will bring destruction to our lives. And so, talking about destruction, I'm just going to move on to the word for destruction. So I'm going to pass up some notes. We'll try to get back to them here. The word I want you to look at is the word shachet. There it is in Hebrew, shachet. Three letters, shin, chet, tav, shachet. It means to ruin, destroy, spoil, corrupt, mar. But there are other words that mean these things, but shachet is very unique. Now I want you to hear how it's used in our passage. Ready? I will, as I read through, I'll use the word shachet where it appears in the text. So go on down to chapter 6, and we will begin with the first place it appears is in verse 11. Now the earth had become shachet before God, and the earth had become filled with Hamas. That's the word Hamas, you know, like the Muslim terrorist group in Palestine. Hamas, that's the word here. Robbery, violent robbery. And God saw the earth, behold, it was shachet. And all flesh had shacheted its way upon the earth. So who's been doing all the shacheting here, all the corrupting? Man has, right? Go on a little bit further. We'll go on down to, we've seen it how many times? Three times so far. Now we come to verse 13. God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with Hamas through them. And behold, I am about to shachate them from the earth. Oh, now who's doing the shachating? God is. And then you go on down to verse 12. And as for me, behold, I am about to bring the flood of waters upon the earth to shechet all flesh in which there is breath. So, who brought the destruction? Mankind or God? Answer is yes. Example, 1 Corinthians 3, 16, 17. Paul writes, do you not know, now follow the logic here, that you are a temple of God. Your body is a temple, all right? God's spirit dwells within it. If you're a believer, then God's spirit, his presence dwells within you. And that the spirit of God dwells in you. If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him. Well, wait a minute. If I'm a temple of God, and I destroy the temple, which is me, I destroy me, what's left for God to do? How can he destroy me if I'm doing it to myself? You see, this is the heart and soul of the word shachet. Here's how you understand the word. You are a temple. But there are two things for your temple to be healthy. First of all, you have to be alive. You have to have life inside of you. God's spirit needs to be there. You, your soul needs to be in there, animating that temple, making it move, making it do, and making decisions. But there's a second thing that your temple needs. It needs things from the outside. It needs clothing, protection, needs a roof over it. It needs people who are going to watch and take care. It needs relationships. So there are all these exterior things you need to have a healthy temple. It needs something from the inside maintaining health. It needs something from the outside maintaining health. There's a division of labor here. And God says, you're a temple. And this is how it works. You are entrusted with taking care of the inside. And if you do that, I will take care of the outside. If you seek my kingdom and righteousness, I'll add the other things onto you. And Paul is basing this passage probably on what happened in Genesis 6, but more so on the Torah, which talks about the curse that comes on someone who damages the temple, damages the tabernacle. Remember, they crucified Yeshua because they misunderstand his words. They use it for an excuse, where he said, destroy this temple, I'll raise up in 3 days. He's talking about the temple of his body and his resurrection, but they thought he's talking about the temple. And to say such a thing to them was deserving of death. And they executed him. Because the temple is sacred. So let's go to the temple in Israel. 70 AD, the temple's destroyed. Who destroyed the temple? Yeah, if you look at the history book, the Romans destroyed the temple. Now, who really destroyed the temple? The Romans was just a hammer. That was just a hammer in someone's hand. Who was holding the hammer? God was. Why did he destroy the temple? Because they had already destroyed it from the inside. The people, the Levites, and the Pharisees, the ones who were in charge there of the temple, they had not maintained the activities of the temple. They had allowed the corruption to come in. What did Yeshua say when he drove out the money changers? My Father's house is to be a house of prayer. You've made it a den of thieves. They destroyed the internal workings. So God brought the hammer to destroy the external. They destroyed, he destroyed. What if they'd maintained health? He would have protected. You understand? That's the sense of shachet. Mankind had ceased maintaining their humanity. So God ceased maintaining his protection of them. There's a powerful lesson here for us in these end times. And I find it so amazing, I've mentioned this before, is in these end days where people move further and further and further away from God and from morality. They laugh at morality and say, who are you to make standards? Well, I'm nobody to make standards. God set them already. But the more they move away from God and his standards, the more they fall in love with the environment and worship the environment. And yet what's happening with the environment? Upheaval. And when you look at the book of Revelation, all of the plagues I see are environmental. They move from the one they should be worshiping, and they place their worship on something else. They're not maintaining their connection with God, so he's not maintaining his protection of the earth. If we return to a place of loving God as a people, he'll maintain his protection of the environment. Am I making sense? Is this making sense? Okay. Please say yes. All right. Now, just this week, it was just yesterday, in fact, I started looking at this word shachet, and a question got answered for me that I've had for years and years and years. When you read that God's description of the tabernacle, he gives all these details, and then he says, now on the roof of the tabernacle, you put on this layer of these embroidered pieces of fabric that are sewn together, then above them you put on these, I think it's ram skins, and above that you put this. And then he says, you know, I want you to put these, and your translations will say something like dolphin skins or porpoise skins. And that's not what they are. Where would they get dolphin skins in the desert? I mean, for Pete's sake. The word in Hebrew is takash skins. And Exodus 25:5, the term is used 13 times in the Torah, all in relationship to the tabernacle. And in 25:5, just one example, you know, you put ram skins dyed red, tachash skins, and acacia wood, and he's giving all this list of materials. But nobody knows what tachash skins are. You know, it doesn't make any difference what they are. I want you to look at the word. There's the word shachet, and there's the word tachash. See what's going on? It's reversed. Shachet is destruction, spoil, corrupt. God's protection being removed from the outside because man has quit maintaining the inside. So shachet comes. But when God reestablishes his connection with man and they follow him and embrace his Torah, he gives them instructions on how to build a tabernacle so he can dwell with them and they can dwell with him and they can be a people, he can be their God, and they can have this sweet communion together. What's the roof made out of? It's the reverse of shachet. It's tachash. I don't need to know what the skin was physically. That doesn't make any difference. Now I know what the essence of the word is. It's the very opposite of the corruption. Here it's true protection. It's the true protection, a godly protection. No, there's one other place where tachash is found in the Bible. It's over in Ezekiel. It's a really interesting use. It's over in Ezekiel. I hope I wrote down the reference. Yes, Ezekiel 16:10. I don't have it on the screen, but you can look it up. And it's talking about God is talking to Israel like his beloved, that he's taken and he's washed her and cleansed her and clothed her and beautified her. I mean, just this language of a man adoring his beloved. And it says he makes slippers for her feet. Guess what the slippers are made out of? Tachash skins. This intimacy that he's clothing her feet with the thing that was the roof of the tabernacle. Think how holy this bride had to be, how elevated, how loved, to take the roofing of the tabernacle, that same material, and I'm making slippers for your feet. That's how much I love you. The tabernacle's a building made out of dead stuff. You're my bride. You're alive. Think about that. It's amazing. Just amazing. All right, we're really getting away from Genesis 6 now, aren't we? So where did I leave off? Let's back up. Oh, okay, let's look at this. I like this is kind of fascinating to me. Yeah, you can look at the notes at home. Genesis 6:9. And by the way, everything from Genesis 1:1 up to Genesis 6:8 is part of the first Torah portion and is read in 1 week's time. How many months have we been on it? This is why it's nice to slow down. Starting with Genesis 6, verse 9, we go into the second week's Torah portion called Noah. So we're all that other stuff would have been covered in 1 week in the synagogue. But that's just too fast. So here in verse 9, it says, these are the offspring of Noah. Noah's a righteous man, perfect in his generations. The word perfect isn't the best word. It's tamim, pure, whole. But it says he was perfect or pure, he's tamim, in his generations. And then later in chapter 7, verse 1, it says, then Adonai said to Noah, go into the ark, you and your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. So the question is, just how whole and pure and righteous Noah really was. To say that he was blameless or righteous in his generation, and you look, he had no competition. Just how righteous is that? And this is a constant, ongoing discussion. And people look at Noah, and Hebrews does call him faithful. He was faithful. He did follow through on the instructions God gave him. Of course, the alternative wasn't very pleasant, but he did follow through on God's instructions. But how, as to being righteous, to being pure, being wholehearted, being blameless, being perfect, it wasn't. In the Midrash Rabbah, there's this friend, what I call a friendly argument, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nehemiah. Rabbi Yehuda says, only in his days was he deemed a righteous man. However, had he been in the generation of Moses or the generation of Samuel, he would not have been deemed a righteous man. In other words, compared to these giants of righteousness, Noah would have been small potatoes. But Rabbi Nehemiah comes along and says, now, if even in his wicked generation he was a righteous man, in other words, with a downward pull of unrighteousness all around him, he still was righteous to some degree. How much more so would he be righteous if he had been in the generation of Moses or the generation of Samuel? I can see both arguments, can't you? But this is where it gets complicated. When I take out Noah and I put me in there, and I ask myself, am I righteous among this generation? And is that how I measure my level of righteousness? I'm a little more righteous than the rest of the run-of-the-mill people in the neighborhood. I'm good enough, better than most. Is that how I measure it? But if I lived in the generation of Moses or Samuel, the people would look at me and think, righteous man? What are we to do? Well, we're not to compare ourselves to Moses or Samuel. We're not to compare ourselves to the generation in which we live. Who are we to be compared to? Yeshua. He is our master. And if we are his students, his disciples, we realize the truth of both of these arguments. That I have a long ways to go. But I know the only one person who, if I follow, I can truly become a righteous man or righteous woman. I know my limitations. And who cares if I'm more righteous than Joe Schmo next door? And maybe I'm not. Maybe I just don't know Joe Schmo very well. I don't compare myself with others. I don't compare myself with you. I compare myself with him. When I compare myself with him, I realize I'm not very righteous. But he is my only hope of ever becoming a righteous man. Make sense? It's an interesting argument, an interesting thing that's posed to us by these passages. Okay. All right, talk among yourselves while I regroup and figure out where I'm at and what we're doing. Okay. I wanted to take a little break from Genesis 6. Because I think it's important to understand the context of what's going on, to understand where things are going. Everything up to this point in Scripture, including the flood, the Tower of Babel, which is just right around the corner, a couple pages away, is leading us up to one towering figure in Scripture. And who is that figure? Abraham. Abraham. Yeah, Nimrod's towering, literally, in the tower, but Abraham, spiritually towering figure, Abraham. And the first 10, 11 chapters of Genesis are all leading up to get us to this man, Abraham. And once we hit Abraham, God hits the brakes and slows us way down, like going through Mogador. Gotta just go slow enough. We got to Abraham. This is where I've been trying to get to. Okay, now we're going to go real slow. Because when you get to Abraham, everything slows down. You've got chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter about this one man. And then you have some chapters about his son Jacob and his sons. But it's Abraham. And as you go through the rest of the Bible, it's always looking back to this towering man of faith, Abraham. You see, Noah was born from a fallen race. You know, you have Adam here. 10 generations, you have Noah. Now, Noah is 10 generations later, and mankind is a wreck. And God uses him to save his wife and his three sons and their wives. He starts a new race of people. But God's going to do something different. He's going to take these descendants of Noah and break them up into 70 nations. And we'll see them all laid out for us later in Genesis. He breaks them up into 70 nations. And the wisdom of that is this. Now, if one nation goes bad, like the generation of the flood, that one nation gets dealt with. The other 69 nations, they are still on their own. But when the whole world is of one language and of one community, when the nation goes bad, the whole nation suffers, and in this case, had to be blotted out. So I'll break them up into 70. That way, if one has to get wiped out over here, one over there, we still have the rest left. And with that said, can you see the dangers of the political climate today trying to come to globalism and put everything back together again? Now, when Messiah comes, I'm all for globalism because we have a Mashiach here who's perfect. He can run the globe just fine. But until he comes, I don't trust any of these nutcases who want to take charge. Because when we come back as one world community, then when things go south, we all go south. We all mess up. And we will see that the whole world will again be destroyed. There is going to be a destruction. So globalism is not a good thing. And thank God a lot of people are starting to stand up and say, no. This is not the direction we go. So just be careful when people start painting globalism as being this good thing. It is a good thing under Messiah. Until then, it's a horrible thing. Horrible thing. And God separated the nations for a purpose. He separated them. He'll bring the nations back together. In the meantime, we can get along with each other, but we stay our own separate nations. That's how it is. Good walls make good neighbors, right? All right. Jim, let's get a microphone over to Jim here. He has his hand up. That's a question. The angels to cast into Tartarus, are they active? No, they're not active right now. They're in chains awaiting judgment. But will they be released later? I don't think so. I don't think God's going to grant parole. But are there other angels who are going to follow suit and do what they did? That's always the question. My inclination is that yes. But I can't prove it. I don't know. Yeah, those are questions that kind of always... It's like an itch in your brain, and you want to scratch it, but you can't because there are just no definite answers for them. No.
I was thinking I shouldn't ask it, and I think I would like not ask it.
No,
you're
just.
What I mean is,
no.
How, if you can't find a place in God's Word,
yeah.
Verses or at least a statement or something about it,
Yeah, well, you know how people will show teasers for a movie or a book or whatever? God invented that. So, Abraham. Abraham then, 10 generations from Noah, as we talked last week, Abraham comes along. He's an idol worshiper. But here's a man who goes completely contrary to the spirit of the world. Instead of being like the 10 generations from Adam down to Noah and just finally God destroys the world, here you find this one soul. And God, it's almost as if God says, I'm going to try something here. Abraham, follow me. I'm not going to tell you where I'm going to take you. Just follow me. And Abraham says, okay. And then God tests him. And Abraham says, all right, I'll still follow you. And there were a couple little stumbles along the way. And he keeps following God. It's almost like that puppy that follows you home and you go, oh, go away, go away. That dog's loyal. He's going to stay with you. And the more he resists your efforts and your tests, the more you realize, this is the dog I want. And finally, the 10th test. He tests Abraham and says, I gave you a son. I told you I would. You believed I would. And then when you were 100 years old, your son was born. Miraculously. And you love that son more than anything on earth. I want you to take that son. I want you to offer him to me. Abraham says, okay. What kind of man does that? What kind of man is so wholehearted towards God from the moment he first calls him until the moment he takes his son up to offer him? There is no man like that. Never was before or since. And God is so impressed. God does the one thing with this man he's never done with anyone else. He makes a blood covenant with him. A blood covenant. That's only done between equals. Yet the creator of the universe makes a blood covenant with this man who was an idol worshiper, a Gentile. But everything in creation was to bring us to Abraham. And then because Abraham was willing to give his son to God, what did God do later? At the same location, God gave his son to us. But there was no ram in the thicket to spare Messiah when they got ready to kill him. He went through with it out of his love for us. And this is why people who are believers, people of faith, Paul says, we're all children of Abraham. Because if we walk in faith, not by sight, we trust what God says, we put one foot in front of the other and continue to follow him, then we're called B'nai Avraham, sons of Abraham. And I pointed this out earlier that in Genesis chapter 2, I pointed this out. In Genesis 2 verse 4 says, this is the account of the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that Adonai Elohim made earth and heaven. And that phrase, when they were created, is just one word in Hebrew. And in every Torah scroll in the world, that word is written like this. It's Bahi Baram. And you see how the second letter of the He is written real small and lifted up? Every Torah scroll in the world has that second letter written small and up. And if it's not, that Torah scroll is invalid. For thousands of years, they've been writing that word, just in that verse, that word, in that verse, that second letter lifted up. And people wonder, why? Why did God ordain back in the early days that the Torah scrolls be written like that? Well, letter He, for one thing, is just like a letter H, just breathe out. So you could, and a bait, when it's attached to the front of a word, means in or with. So you could say, with his breath, Baram, he created. That's one way to translate it. But people have noticed that these letters over here, these five letters together, spell Abraham, Avraham. They say this could mean for Avraham. And that's why God wants to notice that word, made that letter tall. It's like, put a break here and study this. Look at this. Figure this out. Here's a puzzle I'm posing to you. So we could read the verse, this is the account of the heavens and the earth. When they were created for Abraham in the day that Adonai Elohim made earth and heaven. You know, if Shakespeare is probably the greatest playwright in the English language. And what you do is that the plays exist. They've been around for, 400 years? And these plays are these incredible masterpieces of language. Right? So you decide we're going to do a Shakespeare play. What do we need to do to put on this play? We've got the script. We have to build a stage. Build a theater. We have to build a structure upon which this play can be acted out. So which is more important, the structure or the play? 100 years, 200 years from now, which is still going to exist? The stage you built or the play that was acted out on the stage? The play. The play is the eternal thing. That's the thing that endures, not the stage. So God foresaw in the future this one man, Abraham. He thought, this is a story that the universe needs to hear. I'm going to build a stage. And he created the world. You know, in science, we're impressed with bigness. The biggest star, the biggest planet, the biggest building, the biggest animal, the biggest ocean, the biggest mountain, big things impress. Well, in the spiritual realm, big things impress. But since in the spiritual realm there are no things, what is big in the spiritual realm? I'll tell you what's big in the spiritual realm. Stories. Each life here is a story. And you may be the guy who picks up the trash on my street on Tuesday morning. You may be the mail lady. You may be the person who works in the freezer department at the discount grocery store. You may be somebody that the world looks at and says, well, they're nobody important. They're no big person. But then we stand before God, and each of us is called forward, and our life is played out, and we're going to realize some stories are enormous and huge. Incredible stories that impacted lives in ways we didn't know. Another lives we thought were big, this rock star, that football hero, or this politician, he realizes their stories, they're a footnote. There's just a footnote in the story of Quentin Brown or Ron Anderson. They're just a footnote. God placed that person in the White House or placed that person as superintendent of your school or the boss at your business because it was a footnote to your life. It was necessary for your story to be the story that I want it to be. See, that's big. That's the spiritually big things. How big is your story? And you can't measure it by how much money you have, how good looking you are, how many talents you have. It's just, did you follow like Abraham did? God say, oh, this is what you want you to do. This is how I want you to live. You say, okay. So here's this idol worshiper in Ur who basically goes and lives as a shepherd in the desert. What did he ever accomplish? Yet he's got the biggest story of anybody in the Bible, except for Yeshua, the Son of God himself. The second biggest story is Abraham. Think about that. That's amazing. Get what I'm saying here? Yeah, okay. Let's get a microphone over to Steve.
I find it very interesting, the people that God chooses, or the people that Jesus mentions, the woman with two mites, mm-hmm. or the woman that washed his feet with her hair and ointment, and the people that Yeshua chose would not be chosen.
Yeah.
And then the big one would be Saul.
Yeah.
Paul, murder.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? I'm so glad you brought that up, Steve. That's brilliant. Yeah, the woman who gave the two mites. We don't have names for these women. The woman who had the five husbands and was now living in sin there, the Samaritan woman. Nobodies. They're just nobodies. And yet Yeshua, he sees this woman that drops the two mites in the box. Don't even have a name for her. He says, what she's done will never be taken away from her. So, in eternity, you got George Soros over here. Here's the woman who had two little copper tiny coins over here. Who had the bigger story? This is the big story here. This is the one that's elevated. Everybody, look at this. Yeshua says, look at this woman. George Soros gets a footnote. Think about it. It's amazing. Yeah, we could go on and on and on. Yeah, Adam, let's get a microphone to Adam here.
I guess Steve's kind of got me thinking about it again, but earlier, you know, the comparison of was he righteous, you know, for his generation or given, you know, that kind of dialogue.
Yeah.
I guess for me, it really draws out that question of like moment by moment, don't know, I guess there's been a time when I've seen somebody who I know by my personal definition is an unrighteous person.
Right.
But then they do an action which you really couldn't call anything but godly. Mm-hmm. And it's so humbling because I've had times where I see somebody do something and I'm like, man, if they manage to be that loving without really knowing Christ, and I didn't muster that love despite the fact that I claimed to be his disciple, how am I missing the boat that much?
Yeah.
You know, and I think it really, for me at least, you know, those little moments and, you know, came with this next piece of the discussion is how much, like, I think we need to really work at keeping ourselves aligned with the story.
Yeah.
You know, how easy it is to get distracted and get caught up. You know, for me, it's probably, you know, those stupid little games you play online, you know, like, I need to hit level 50 and then I could go to life.
Yes.
You know, everybody does that, but they have their things, something silly in the car, getting caught up in the own 80-hour work week or, you know, television shows, whatever it is, we get caught up in that and we disconnect from the story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I appreciate that. Great insight. And it's like you're reading my mind, because I think the same thing. Because I'll meet somebody and I'll look down and, you know, they're just kind of disheveled and maybe have a cigarette hanging out. They're using bad language. And then God opens my eyes to see an act of righteousness in that person. It puts me to shame. May the congregational leader Beth Taku, you know. And it's like, oh, Lord, this is, why can't I be more like him? And less like me. I know exactly what you're saying. Does everybody identify with what Adam is sharing? Okay. Well, listen, our time is gone. I'm going to give you some homework for next week. Talk about big and little things. The word for ark that's used here in Genesis is the word teva. Teva. It's only used in two accounts anywhere in the Bible. It's the word that's applied to the ark that Noah built. And it's applied to another watercraft someone else built. Any guesses as to what that watercraft was? What? Yes, the basket that his mother Jochebed built that put baby Moses in on the Nile River. Okay, the Ark of the Covenant, that's the word Aron, not Teva. That's a whole different word. I don't know why they use the word English word Ark for both, because it's distracting. The word Teva is used for Noah's Ark. And the basket that Moses is placed in. Only two things. There are two places where it's found. Your job this week is to take those two stories, make columns, and then compare. I mean, one obvious difference is what? One is enormous, the other one's tiny. Right? One's built by a man, one's built by a woman. But there are similarities as well. So just keep going back and forth, because what you have is a menorah pattern. You have branches this way. Noah's ark, Jochebed's ark. Put them side by side. Because when God uses one word for two different stories, then you're supposed to put the stories side by side. So come with your list next week, and we'll take a look at them, and we'll try to see if, because I know you'll come up with some I won't think of. All right? So that's your job. So these two stories will now enlighten one another. Okay? Any last-minute comments or questions burning in your mind that you have to share right now? No? Okay. Well, we'll close then. Father, thank you for this time, for your word, for your blessing, for truth, for the light that brings into our lives. And Lord, I pray none of us would ever overestimate or underestimate our stories. Some of us might be a general who wins some great battle on the field of combat. But another person might be one who wins a battle against addiction. Or a battle against fear. Hopelessness or anger. And those are the really big stories. So, Father, let us not invest in the world that we see, but in the real world. That's the source of this one. The eternal world. For the things we see are just temporal. But the unseen things, those are the eternal things. Make our lives count. Make us the people you want us to be, so that we can give you more praise than we would otherwise. And we give you praise and thanks now in Yeshua's name. Amen.